Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to episode 497, the best of. It's a repeat episode with Leah McCord. It's from 2011, and it is a good, good episode. I encourage you to continue listening. What the fuck? I am currently on break. I've taken July off. We'll be back with new episodes in August. Our sponsor for today is BetterHelp.com, online counseling. If you want to know more about it, I'm a big fan, go to BetterHelp.com/mental. Make sure you include the slash mental part so they know you came from this podcast. And then just fill out a questionnaire. And if they have a counselor that they feel is a good fit for you, they'll match you up with one. And you can experience a free week of counseling to see if online counseling is right for you. And you need to be over 18. If you are between 13 and 17, they'll direct you to teencounseling.com, and they'll contact your parents, get consent there, and then from then on, the relationship between the teen and the counselor is completely private, and it satisfies all legal requirements in all 50 states. And without any further ado, here is a replay of the episode with Leah McCord. My interview today with Leah McCord is a couple of things I want to tell you about it. At the end of the interview, after we wrapped things up, Leah had kind of this weird look on her face, and I said, "Is something wrong?" She said, "Well, there was something I wanted to talk about, but I didn't. And let me run it by you what I wanted to say." And so she ran it by me, and I said, "That would be great if you would talk about that on the air." So, at the end of her interview, you will hear her come back. We pick up the interview again, and it's worth sticking around for because it's very brave what she shares, and I think profound. And I'm just really grateful that I have guests who are willing to risk the judgment of other people to share what they believe is the truth and is coming from their heart. And what she said made total sense to me as well. So also, there's a friend of hers that she talks about in the podcast who since passed away, totally unrelated to her story. But because her friend was involved in drugs, her family would prefer that the friend's name wasn't mentioned. So you'll hear me bleep her friend's name throughout the podcast. Before we get to the interview with Leah, as I told you, there's a survey you can take. It lets me get to know you guys a little bit better. And I go through there and I look at the responses that people have sometimes. And every once in a while, I just feel absolutely compelled to read somebody's responses on one of the shows. And so I want to read you. I just love this woman wants to be her nickname is Porcelain. She's in her 20s. She's a student at NYU. The environment that she was raised in, she writes, totally chaotic. She says that she is a vegan. She does go to therapy, and she says, I have to say my therapist is utterly amazing. My whole life, people either ignored or were simply too shocked to ever respond to the details of my life. I always love hearing that when I see that somebody is going to get therapy and it's working for them. She has ADHD, and she takes stimulants for it, and she says that that aggravates her anxiety. To the question, do you share your feelings with anyone on a regular basis? She writes, yes, but I don't know if it helps. I share my feelings because I have this awful habit of never filtering out my thoughts, ever, and I'm pretty sure it offends people a lot. I'm surprised I have the few friends that I do. Let's see, what else does she say? What are the most common negative thoughts you have? She writes, I'm always worried that people are just humoring me, that they pretend to be okay with me, but in reality think I'm absurdly fucking strange. It's not their opinions that would frighten me, but the fact that I am just so blind to it, like an autistic retard. I also consistently think I'm huge, that I'm wasting my education, that I'm trying to play with the real smart people, but I'm actually pretty stupid and have only gotten as far as I have in academia on a fluke. Oh, and my overwhelming body hair. I'm constantly loathing how much hair I have for a girl and feel like it just gets worse and worse. I fucking love this woman. Describe any behaviors you wish you didn't engage in, but you do anyway. She writes, biting my nails and eating my skin. I'm not sure what that exactly means, eating your skin. She writes, digging into my legs with pins and tweezers. I hear this is something meth addicts do, and my ADHD meds are a form of meth, so makes sense. Also eating too much, procrastinating, oh, and sitting on the toilet for hours waiting to poop because I'm not convinced I've pooped all I have for the day and I'm worried that my stomach is still building too much because of all the poop. Oh, my God. I can never get enough honesty from people like this. Another behavior that she says she engages in, but wish she didn't so much. She says, masturbating a lot, even though I live with my boyfriend, and obsessively shopping only to return everything the next day. To the question, does anything cause you to feel ashamed? She writes, living in New York City, going to NYU, I'm consistently ashamed that I can't be as thin and toned as everyone around me. I feel like they're all looking at me and thinking, that flabby bitch can't exhibit any self-control. How can she possibly be here right now? To the question, does anything cause you to feel guilty? She writes, I'm pretty materialistic, especially when I'm feeling pretty antisocial. I shop for clothes, always imagining how beautiful I will look so I can go out in the world again and people will like me. I'm actually a poor college student and I engage in this all the time while my boyfriend is struggling to afford food. Does anything cause you to feel angry? She writes, I'm angry that my boyfriend wants to be a woman. I don't care if he ever switches his dick for a vagina, but I want to be the metaphorical girl in the relationship, and I get so mad that he exhibits no sort of chivalry or protectiveness towards me, ever. To the question, if there is a God, what are some of the things you would say to God? She writes, I would thank him for blessing me with more than enough food, clothing, etc., and access to good people and a great education. Then I would apologize for wasting it all. And then to the question, do you have any comments or suggestions to make the podcast better? She says, I want to thank you actually for this podcast. You launched it on iTunes just as I was hitting a very, very dark place in my life. It was just awesome to hear about people who were once in that exact place, but were now totally social and usually pretty happy. Inspirational shit never includes the gritty, gross details that your podcast does, and it does wonders for helping me relate. As I've been picking myself up again, it's nice to listen and remember how I felt during the old podcasts and measure my progress. So thanks. Well, Porcelain, I don't know you, but I feel like I know you, and you fucking rock. Hair and all.
Everybody, yeah. I know is bizarrely, beautifully fucked up in some weird way.
I couldn't stand you in the audition.
I couldn't stand you.
Yes, yeah. Awful. Yeah. I was drunk.
And I learned that I could solve my problems.
And sad.
Through violence, since I couldn't communicate.
Lonely?
Yes. I'm afraid that my genitalia is ugly.
That's hurtful.
And what was your role in the robbery?
I mean, you never knew what you were going home to.
I had a jar that had teeth in it.
I was a wreck.
Other people's teeth?
Yeah.
I'm here with Leah McCord. And, Leah, one of the great things about, for me, having a terrible memory is I'm going to almost get to hear your story again for the first time. I was watching TV about 6 months ago, and I was watching this show, Locked Up Abroad, and I saw your story, and I was like, I would love to get her on the podcast because, for one, it's an interesting story, but two, something told me that there was something about your story that made it good for this podcast. Let's start from the beginning. And are you comfortable talking about your childhood and
Sure.
stuff you went through? And what was your home life like growing up?
It was difficult. Right. I come from a large family, and my father.
How many kids?
Six.
Mm-hmm.
Six of us. And I'm the next.
And you grew up where?
In Houston, Texas, for the most part. We traveled a little bit when I was younger, mm-hmm. but around third grade, we settled down in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was in computers. He was a consultant, so he did a lot of contract work, 1099 work. And so when he didn't want to deal with the 1099s and file his taxes, that led to my issues after high school trying to get financing for college.
Mm-hmm.
But before we get to that, it's probably good to say what put me in a mindset that I was willing to make the choice I made at 18 years old.
Yeah.
And my father grew up in his own broken home, and as a result, the cycle continued with us. I was sexually molested from the time I was 7 years old, 7 or 8 years old, until junior high school. And we turned him in multiple times.
Your father?
My father.
Yeah.
My father. And my mom would, is Hispanic. My mom's Mexican, and she wanted to keep the family together. It was a sign of failure for herself if she couldn't keep her family unit together. So, I understand her mentality, but she made some poor choices for the safety of us children in an effort to maintain that unit that was fractured from so many levels. But so he went to jail a couple of times before he was finally sent away for 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
And we went, my sister, my brother, and I were pulled out of my mom's house for a year to stay with my grandparents in Dallas, Texas. And then we came home, and Dad was still in jail, and she took us to see him. And then he came out of jail, and he was in an apartment away from the house, and she took us to visit him. And as soon as the, unfit mother restrictions on him being there were lifted, she had him back in the house. And along with the sexual abuse, he was emotionally abusive. We were stupid, and we were spanked. We mm-hmm. went to school with long pants on all summer mm-hmm. long. So it was, it was just not happy. And he and Mom would fight, and they would wake us up in the middle of the night. Mm.
Did the abuse end once he went to prison? The sexual abuse, did that
yeah,
end?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, okay, he still wanted me to sit on his lap inappropriately. Things like that would happen. I was like, oh. And Mom was...
What would you say to him when he would do...
I would just look at him, and I would shake my head no and sit somewhere else.
And you were like 7 or 8 at that
point? But when he came out of jail, I was 15, 14.
And wanted you to sit on his lap at 14
yes.
or 15. Wow.
Yeah.
So he really did not...
He didn't really
He did
recover.
Not work on himself. He did not try to get to the root of
he
why...
He is wicked smart. And yeah. he read the psychology books and knew exactly what to say and what not to say to pass their tests, what the picture's not supposed to look like.
So a master manipulator.
Yes, very much so, yeah. which we inherited, I think. I have to catch myself not doing that to other people.
Yeah. That's so good that you're aware of it, though, because most people that were manipulated then in turn learn how to manipulate, and that's their blunt tool, their coping mechanism. But go ahead. So that
was what was going on. So in high school, I was constantly trying to get him to be proud of me, despite the other thing, I was still my father, and I still wanted him to be proud. So I was working after school to pay for outfits to be on the dance team, and I was on the dance team in high school, and I was a honor student and went on the trip with the dance team. And went to UT to visit the campus because I wanted to go to UT when I graduated. I had a couple of girlfriends that were going to go. And we all took the trip and saw the campus. And I was like, yeah, you should go. Definitely check it out. And when it came time to fill out the financial aid forms, oh, well, we haven't really filed our taxes in the last 4 or 5 years. So you need to leave that stuff blank. Well, that doesn't do me any good. Yeah. I can't prove how broke. We're so broke, we can't prove we're broke. So I was unable to pay for college. And I'd gotten accepted and still couldn't go. So my best friend in high school, she lived a few blocks up the road, but her parents owned that house. We always rented. My parents have never owned a house. They'd never saved money. It was, you know, her parents owned this house, and she went on annual vacations, like to, you know, out here and things mm-hmm. like that from Texas. And so, but she was bored. Yeah, everything she ever wanted, she got. She never had to work a day in her life. And one of two children.
She probably thought your life was so exciting.
She was like, you've got so much drama. Like, she would come and rescue me from the house. Like, I would call her upset. And she, you know, my dad had gone off on me about something. And she would come and just say, I'm taking you out of here. You're coming with me. And we would go hang out at her in her bedroom. And it freaked me out was in the morning, she would get up and she'd have her little tank top and underwear on. And she'd walk down the hall to go to the bathroom with her dad at the house. And I was like, aren't you going to put some clothes on? And she goes, it's my dad. I said, right. That's normal. That's supposed to be okay.
Oh, that's so sad.
So I realized that's not everybody's experience. And actually when I was
And what was your friend's name? You don't have to say if you don't.
Yeah, I'd rather not. Okay. Her sister didn't want me to mention her anymore. She's passed since I got back. It was moments like that hit me. And so when I didn't get into college, she says, well, you know what? Let's just move out. She says, you were both 18. We can move out and get an apartment.
And she had no desire to go to college?
She was ready to put it off for a year.
I see.
Was she
kind of a party girl? Or?
When we went out to parties, like the high schools, you know, the drama team, I was all about drama in high school.
Yeah.
So we went to the senior cast party, and she would be the one that would get drunk and be smoking and start clinging to the really unattractive guy, and I was constantly pulling her off, and okay, now it's time to go home, and would drive her home. So I would get silly too, and when I was a bad night, she took me out, and I got really, really drunk and blacked out, and apparently danced on the table at the male strip joint downtown Houston, but I apparently, I needed it. She like let me just, you know, cut loose, and then she drove me home and took care of me that day. Oh, actually, she left me in her lawn. I passed out on her grass. She just let me sleep there. But I was, that was by, she was by my kind of my anchor, you know, I would go to her. And so when we moved out, we had started modeling lingerie outfits and doing the little raffle contests at, you know, hotel lounges and a couple little bars down in Galveston. And so, I had, 18 years old, of course, you have a cute figure. I mean, who didn't look cute at 18? So, I did well at the crappiest places. Because I just was happy-go-lucky, la-la-la, yeah, la, look at that, stop it. So, but I hated it. I mean, it was just...
That had to have been so painful for somebody who was objectified their whole childhood.
It's a weird thing. I think anybody who's been through childhood molestation can tell you it's a weird thing. You want to be cute. You really want to be cute and recognized and appreciated, but then at the same time, you hate yourself for thinking about that, and suddenly it's a bad thing.
Yeah, it's like you discover your power. It's a power that you hate having, but it's power nonetheless.
Right. And it's like, is that what you like about me? Now, is that all that people like about me? Because, I mean, I went on a binge on Facebook one night. If anyone else tells me I am sexy, I'm going to slap them, because I need more than sexy at this point.
And you know what? A lot of men, I think, don't understand that. Yes, women want to be attractive, but they want to be more than that. They want to be recognized for their intelligence or their empathy or their sense of humor or something else. It's great to have the attractive thrown in as icing on the cake, but I think very few people want that to be the most important thing about them, because it's going to change. You're going to get old, and that's not going to be there forever.
Right.
The thing I love about you most is disappearing every day.
Exactly.
You know, who wants to hear that?
Diminishing as we speak.
Yeah.
So that was something that I was doing after high school, and I didn't like it, and I wanted to be, and I would see the commercials on TV. Now, this is really cute. It makes me laugh to think about it. But there was the Bradford Business School, and it would show the girl, like, in her jeans and t-shirt, and she's all bored, and, you know, but she wants to do better. And then she goes to the Bradford Business School and she comes out in this executive suit with a briefcase. And they just like, she's going places. She's a Bradford grad. And they had, you know, and they're, my big dream was to have the money to go and become an executive assistant after graduating from Bradford Business School for, you know, executive assistants. I wanted a briefcase. I wanted a suit and some little pumps. And so I went to the Bradford School and they said, it's $8,000. And I was like, oh my God. Okay, well, we'll see. And then I went back and I, you know, of course, I didn't have two pennies to rub together. We were barely paying our rent at this new apartment. So I said, well, I'm going to start waitressing at this strip club. I was like, oh, I could do that. You know, I've always had a fairly big top section. So I was like, I should be able to get good tips if I go and waitress at a strip joint. Mm-hmm. So I went in to talk to the guy and he goes, honey, with all of that, you are not waitressing. You're going to be on my stage or you're not working here. And I don't know if he thought that was going to convince me, like, well, okay, then make me a star. Right. No, I was like, well, then I'm not working here because this is not going on display.
Yeah.
So I was stuck once again, not being able to keep up with Bill, her making money.
Now, just let me stop you for a second. What is, in your mind, what was the difference between doing the lingerie modeling and being in a strip club? It was just there was a line somewhere between there that you just weren't comfortable crossing.
Well, we always wore tights underneath the lingerie, and we were never topless.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, and it wasn't today's lingerie. It was near 1991 lingerie.
I suppose also because it was
a lot more open.
And it was in a hotel lobby, which is certainly
and it was
different.
Yeah. Dark and
I gotcha.
Yeah.
I gotcha.
Yeah. So it was not. I was not naked.
It was creepy classy.
It was creepy classy. Exactly. It was a tickety tack classy, and so. I wasn't going to strip. I was not going to be taking my clothes off for money. I couldn't do it. It was not something I was comfortable doing. So I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And then while she was working there, she met this one of the customers there was an importer-exporter, quote unquote. And he said, you know, you're really special. You're very smart. You shouldn't be wasting yourself here. You know, you should work for me. And she's like, well, doing what? And he says, well, I could get you a job. You could export some stuff from import some stuff for me from Bulgaria. And a week and a half, you'd make $10,000 cash. And you could do that as often as you wanted. So she was like, well, okay, sure. So she comes home and she's like, yeah, Lee, oh my gosh, I met this guy. It's going to be great. I'm going to Sofia, Bulgaria. Can you believe it? And I said, whoa, are you sure it's going to be okay? And she says, yeah, it's like diamonds. It's no big deal. So she went to Bulgaria. She calls me. She's staying at this fabulous 5-star hotel. She went on a tour and she's, you know, it's so crazy here. It's so different because, you know, in Texas, it's no joke. Texas knows about Texas. There's not Texas, America, and then there's everything else.
It really is like its own separate country.
We really barely care about anything other than that. So Bulgaria was, it could have been China, it could have been Mongolia. It was all, you know, not Texas.
Where's the mall, y'all?
Where's the McDonald's, y'all? So she comes back and sure enough, she's got cash. You know, he gave it to her in like 20s. She flew into Atlanta, mm-hmm. made her delivery at some motel, and then got on the plane and came to Houston. And she's got money in her chest, money in her shoes, money in her lined along the edges of the suitcase, so she didn't have to claim the $10,000.
Sure.
And I was like, oh my God, all I need is $8,000 and I can go to school. And for like $1,000, I could get a piece of crap car because I didn't have my own car. Like, mm-hmm. she was my ride, she was everything. So, like, and then I'd have a little bit of money left over to help mom pay some bills. So I said, well, all right, I want to talk to this guy. You know, Bulgaria sounds exciting, you know. And so she took me to, we went to this, like, Olive Garden, big fancy place. And we meet this guy, and he's a black gentleman. He's wearing a suit. He's got kind of a British accent with his, when he speaks. And he says, wow, you really are. You're everything she said. You're very special. I'm like, you know, and I think back, corn. How corny is that? You know, right. Of course, at 18, that's exactly what I wanted to hear. Yes, of course I'm special.
Yes.
Look at me.
Yes.
And he says, you know, I really think that this would be a really good opportunity for you. However, for you, I'm thinking we should probably send you somewhere a little different with your look. You should probably go to, like, thinking Bangladesh. And I was, excuse me? What's a Bangla what? And he says, Bangladesh. It's in India. And I said, India? Wow. Like with elephants and stuff? And he said, yeah. I said, okay, well, what? You know, give me some details here. What am I taking? What are we transporting? And he says, well, it's actually, she said it's like gold or diamond or something. And well, he goes, not exactly. He goes, it's worth more than its weight in gold, though. And I said, well, what? And he says, well, it's actually, he's like lip syncing. He goes, it's heroin. And I literally jumped out of my chair. You may have lit a fire under my seat, like I said on the show. I said, you know, what? Because we had a friend in high school, and I, that his brother committed suicide. And then he would write poems about how hurt he was at losing his brother because his brother got messed up on pills and he killed himself. Well, then he proceeded to get messed up on pills and killed himself. And we went to his funeral, and his father, having lost both of his sons, stood up in front of the church and said, please make a promise to me, all of you students, that you will not ever have anything to do with drugs. I don't want any other parents to ever have to suffer this. So we made this pact. Like, we all held hands and made a pact that we were not going to do anything with drugs. And so I looked at her and said, is that what you did? She says, calm down, Leah, sit down. Shh. You're freaking out. Relax. And I said, I'm sorry. I won't do it. I said, I am not bringing drugs, heroin, into this country. I have little brothers. There's just no way. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, I appreciate that. I respect that. That's totally understandable. Cindy, she's got a point. Totally pandering to me and sure. says, what if I had you take it to Switzerland? It's practically legal there. You know, Reader's Digest had just done a thing on Needle Park, which I had actually read. Mm-hmm. And so I said, Switzerland. Well, we do have Needle Park. And he goes, you know what? I will give you twice as much. He goes, you want to help your mom out, right? You want to pay some bills for your mom and you want to go to college. He goes, I'll give you twice as much as I gave her. She's going to be doing something really big for me. And I said, $20,000.
And this is in what year?
1991.
Yeah.
Well, 92. It was January of 92. Yeah. And I was like, whew. All right. Okay, I'll do it, but just this one time, and I'm not bringing it here. And he goes, no, you don't have to bring it here. No problem. So.
And then he said, and whatever you do, don't rent Midnight Express.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, if you've ever heard, no. I was so naive. I was thinking I'm going to see elephants, and it'll be like an adventure. It'll be a jungle. I was like excited. And I got there. When I got off that plane, I had never left America. Like, we drove down to Mexico, I think, once when I was younger to see my mom's grandparents and something. I was like, but we never flew anywhere out of the country. I had no idea what to expect. Mm-hmm. And didn't, like, the American embassy, you're supposed to check in. I had no idea. So I get out of the airport, and they have this system where all the rickshaw drivers come up, and they try and help you because it's money. They're all trying to make their money, and they're like, excuse me, madam, help you, madam, help you, madam. And they're grabbing at my suitcase, and they're the whole personal space thing we have in America, non-existent over there. Mm-hmm. And they don't smell very good. So I was just like, whoa, it was accosted with noise and smells and the language I didn't understand, and their accent was funky. And I found out later it was a plant. This cab driver came and walked through, and he says, excuse me, would you like some help? Perfect British accent. And I was like, oh, yes. And he goes, I will take you to a hotel. Come with me. And so he took me to a guest house that was crappy. And then I decided I wanted to spend my last couple of days on my visa waiting for the dude at the fancy hotel. Went to the fancy hotel and checked in. It was 5 stars. And
then you pay for the stay in the fancy
hotel? He gave me some spending cash. He gave me like $1,500, which was to cover the hotel, the taxi, and my food and everything.
This episode is sponsored by When Breath Becomes Air. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, what makes a life worth living, as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we are alive, a must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor turned patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present? When the future is no longer a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean to have a child, to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a #1 New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And of course, I didn't go to the cheap places for food because I was American. I went wherever they had dollar symbols, like dollars accepted. Like, yes, okay. I didn't exchange my money until much later. Someone said, get some taco. It's a lot cheaper if you use taco. And I said, okay, yeah, sure. They probably have different money here. I mean, just completely ignorant. I mean, it's for all the studying I did and for all the honor student I was in high school. It just, I had no training or education of what to expect overseas. Okay. So let me skip ahead. Stayed there, I thought I was having fun. Got sick, had to stay a couple extra days, which worked out for them because the guy bringing the drugs was delayed. And then had a really scary experience. I was going to run away. Mm-hmm. The guy was late bringing me the drugs. It was the day I was supposed to leave. It was the last day of my visa. And I was like, you know what? I am going to escape. Like, I'm not going to do this. I don't want to miss my flight. I'm just getting freaked out. So the hotel had a policy where you check in your luggage when you check in. And then once you pay the bill, they give you this little coin thing that says your bill's paid. And then the bellboy will take the coin and take your luggage out. So you're not supposed to run off without paying your bill.
Right.
Well, I was planning to do just that because I didn't have enough money to pay the bill. I'd stayed too many days at the fancy hotel. Mm. So I took my suitcase and I like sneak out of my room into the stairwell. I think I'm just going to go down and go out like the service desk, service entrance, you know, and I'll just sneak out. Well, I run, schlepping this suitcase full of all these roses that I got because someone at the hotel was offensive and apologized for giving me a bunch of roses. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's the first time anybody's ever given me roses. I'm going to keep all of them. So I'm running down the stairs with this suitcase full of flowers and stuff, and I get to the bottom, finally panting, and I open the door thinking it's going to be like the kitchen or, you know, some service area, and it is the middle of the lobby. Mm-hmm. Like in the middle of all of the glorious mirrors, and everyone's like, oh, crap. So I was like, well, maybe I just keep my head down and just kind of go, you know. So I pull my suitcase out and I'm trying to just, you know, walk. And of course, all the bellboys looking for their tip money, this is their livelihood, throng to me. Oh, can I help you, madame? Ma'am, can I help you? You help with your bags? And I was like, no, I've got it. Where's your coin? Maybe we'll carry your bags. I was like, no, I've got it. I'm going to carry them. Where's my coin? Crap. And as this is all happening, the guy, Tony, that was bringing me the drugs shows up. And he is a very scary person. He's not Mr. Rico Suave that I met in Texas. He is intense. He's very hardcore. And he spotted me. And I was like, man. He came across and he was like, where are you going? And he grabbed my passport out of my hand. And he goes, you're not running away. Here's your money. Go pay your bill. Meet me out front. So I go out. I go to pay my bill and they're like watching. Are you okay? Are you okay? And I said, oh, yeah, yeah. I was raised at home that we didn't tell what my dad was doing, abusing us, because the authorities aren't going to help you. So I had this just mechanism, and like, you know, when someone asks you if you're okay, you just say yes.
Right.
You can't trust them to do anything. So I didn't go to counselors at school when I was being abused because they would break up the family, and I didn't tell the people at the desk I'm being coerced.
Right.
You know, so many things that a normal child, I think, would have registered and would have reacted differently because of what I went through. I just kind of head down, took my punishment, thinking that that's what I had to do. And so I did. I got to the rickshaw, and he was mad. And I don't like anybody being upset at me. That's just my mentality from forever. So even though he's a criminal, I still don't want him mad at me for some reason. Right. Like, that matters. Right. So we went to his guest house, which was the same guest house I'd been dropped off at, which was how I knew that cab driver was a plant. I was supposed to actually be there, and it would have been a lot easier. It was just part of why he was annoyed. But so he wanted to put them in my suitcase, the packages. But I had all these flowers and two big metal vases that they had come in. They were taking up a significant chunk of space. And he says, you can't take these, or it's not going to fit. I'm throwing these away. And I was like, this is the moment that I got some gumption. Worst moment was at this moment. I said, you know what? No, I am keeping those roses. You cannot tell me I have to throw them away. I'm keeping them. They're mine. They're staying. Because... all right, fine. Then you're going to have to wear the product. And I said, okay, fine, I will. You know, at this point, that was the worst thing I could have done. If it's in your suitcase, you have some plausible deniability. There's so many reasons not to do that.
Right.
But I decided to fight for my roses.
Wow. Wow.
I know, it's terrible. But so I put on this horrible girdle, and these packages of the heroin were wrapped in coffee grounds and sprayed with opium perfume to kind of throw off the dogs. It was just...
Hold on for one second. Do you think there's a significance in the fact that those roses meant so much to you that you were willing to make this mission more dangerous, that someone's expression of you being special to them was so profound and important to you,
right?
That it's colored true. That it colored the logistics of you doing this thing. What did those flowers make? Who had given you these flowers?
The marketing guy from the hotel had asked me out to dinner, and we went to dinner. And on the way back from dinner, he behaved inappropriately because I was an American woman traveling on my own, and he just had a set expectation.
Right.
And, you know, went to smell my hair and put his, like, burying his face in my neck, and I pushed him out and was like, get away from me. Don't ever come near me. And he was mortified. Yeah, I guess it meant a lot to me. I didn't, you know, no one had...
Nobody had ever done that for you.
Yeah, Dad certainly didn't do that.
Yeah.
For all of the stuff that he did. I never got roses from Dad. I didn't get any apologies from Dad.
Wow.
So, I mean, he said he's sorry, but then he's recanted. You know, he goes back and forth his defending actions, himself. And so...
It sounds like your dad's actions always undermined anything that he had to say.
Right. I mean, and now that he's, you know, he's 60-some years old and he's had a stroke and, I mean, a heart attack, and I'm in contact with him, and we've reached, you know, I forgive him. I wouldn't have my children around him alone, but I still talk to him. He's my father, and I get where he was coming from. I kind of know. I know why he's broken.
He was a sick person.
Yeah, I realize he's broken. We're all broken in our own way, and he's come a long way. So, but so that was a big, I guess it was kind of, it was weird that I decided to fight for those. And I had sworn I wasn't, and I think it was meant to be.
Yeah.
That I wore it, and actually, you know, when I went through security, actually, they were body searching, and I got caught.
Yeah.
And so I was arrested trying to smuggle the
heroin.
And
did you know that the drug smuggling penalties were stiff in Bangladesh?
I had no idea. Yeah. I had no clue.
I'm sure the guy didn't tell you.
Yeah, he doesn't tell you if you get caught, this was going to happen. No, the guy in the rickshaw tells me, look, don't get any ideas. Don't think you're going to go throw the stuff away. He says, we're watching you.
Right.
And my friend was back home, and I knew they knew where she was, and I didn't want to put her in any danger, and so I was like, I'm just going to go through with it, you know. Suck it up. I can do this. And so they had been tipped off at the airport. And the DEA, when I spoke to them later on, they suspected that there was an even larger shipment in some kind of box or like a bag full of heroin going behind me, but, you know, we don't know for sure.
The Bangladeshi DEA or the
American
DEA. So they were working in concert with each other?
They came to see me after I was arrested. Uh-huh. When I was in jail, they came to talk to me. They called me, the one guy called me sly. He was very sly.
I was like,
I'm not sly. I don't like that adjective. And he kept using it. I think it was like one of those things to like get me to keep talking.
So was the American DEA on your side after you got arrested? Were they on your side because they wanted to use you to help bust this larger ring? Had they tried. Had they been aware of your complicity in this even before you were arrested?
No, they had not been aware.
Okay.
So they found out, when the embassy found out, and it all got reported out up the chain through customs and everything, I guess, the DEA guys came to talk to me, and I was happy to tell them all that that's like, there's a girl that's in Switzerland waiting for me. She's going to fly back home empty-handed.
Sure. Because these people, there's at least a chance that you're going to get your story heard and
be able to go home. I was like, you know, can I testify against the guy in the States? I mean, they looked for him, and they actually reached out to my friend to see if she could tell them, you know, give them the contact information. And of course, she was, I'm sure, threatened and scared out of her wits and denied everything. Didn't know where I was, didn't know what I was talking about. And so they couldn't find him. Like, they were looking around Houston, like they went into the woodlands areas looking for him to be hiding out, and they could not find this person. So someone asked me once, are you afraid he's going to find you? And I said, no, I really don't ever think about him. But I did try and cooperate. I told them as much as I could, and I thought for sure that they were going to fly me home. But they didn't have, and I don't know that we do even now, but they didn't have an exchange agreement to where you can bring the American prisoner back and put me in an American jail, which actually would have been worse. I think being an American in a Bangladesh prison was really a... Not a bad. I mean, it wasn't nice, but it was better than being an American in an American prison.
Wait, hold on. Being in a Bangladeshi prison was nicer than being in an American prison?
For treatment-wise. Not necessarily the accommodations. I mean, it was hot, there was no air conditioning, there was no heat. I mean, it was tropical weather. But I had a position of esteem with them. I had a separate cell away from the other prisoners.
I see, because you were from another country, or specifically America.
They treated Westerners, British. There were some British gentlemen in the men's side that had a separate cell. Anybody with money could pay to have a cell. Like this one woman, a garment factory owner, paid her way to share the cell with me. And I got a better diet. And basically anything I said was, you know, they treated it with respect. And the embassy came to make sure I was taken care of and well-fed. And the jail knew that. So they were very conscientious.
Did you have any clue as to how lucky you were, given the fact that you were already unlucky and that you got caught? Did you have any clue that it could have been so much worse?
At the time, no.
Okay.
No, I didn't have any idea. I mean, I was making friends and making the most of my time there. I learned the language because they didn't speak English very well. And so I learned to read and write it because they had books. The women would bring their children with them because the husbands remarry and then the kids are firstborn and their life's in danger. I mean, it's that kind of a society. It's so crazy.
What do you mean that the children are firstborn and then their lives are in danger?
So everything is about inheritance, like land ownership and things like that. It's inherited and passed down. So like Bible, think of the Bible, you know. So the men would marry these women. They'd have a kid. And if the woman gets arrested for theft or framed for murder because their family has valuable land and somebody wants to develop on it and nobody wants to sell, they would frame them for murder or some other horrible thing and send these women to prison. And the women, more often than not, would choose to bring their children with them into the jail rather than leave them with their husband because he's going to remarry. And the new wives, there were some women in jail with me who had killed their senior wife's child.
Wow.
Because that means more inheritance for their own children. So that was, and that was bananas to me to go in there and have these children serving time with us. But it was also a nice little reprieve because the kids were cute and I got to play with them.
That had to have been, on some level, really soothing to have that innocence around in this place that's just so, I would imagine, cynical and frightening.
Well, they were praying. I mean, it's a Muslim country, which I didn't know anything about at the time, but they were all doing their prayer. They got the call to prayer 5 times a day, and they were all in a troublesome time, and that's when you go to your faith. That's when you reach out to your,
And were you somebody that had any faith before you went?
We were raised evangelical Christians. Right. The Bible was the truth, and there was only the Bible, and we believed it, and we went to camp revivals and stuff. I mean, we were...
Okay. So I mean, because I also went through that stuff in Catholic grade school, but I was just kind of, I felt like I was pushed into doing it. So, I mean, you could, like, be raised evangelical Christian and still, your soul's not into it.
Yeah, I
doubted. But your soul was into it, kind of?
I had questions because it was coming from my dad, and my dad was doing what my dad was doing.
Right.
So,
That's gotta fuck you up.
It really screwed you up. Know,
that's a really bad message to give.
So,
God loves you, but we're gonna put that on the back burner for about 15 minutes.
Yeah. You know? And his Bible, his belt that he spanked us with was 2 inches wide, and it was embossed with Jesus loves you in a rainbow.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not.
Are you kidding?
I'm not even kidding. It was, we had J-E and S-U-S imprinted on our skin.
Are you kidding?
You think I, no, not at all.
Did he get that at the You Gotta Be Shitting Me store?
Yeah, exactly.
I need something I need to whoop my kids with. What would be the most ironic?
Exactly.
Oh my God.
Well, spare the rod and whatever that scripture is. He felt like he was really showing
spare
his
love. Spare the rod, spoil the child.
Yeah, he felt like he was really serving us by spanking us.
Oh my God. So you're in this prison, and had you been sentenced yet at this point?
No. I'm trying to think, the timeline gets fuzzy. You know, it took a long time for my court dates to actually start. They chased down, they did find the guy who gave me the drugs, trying to cross into India. And we had an
It's so easy to catch a rickshaw. You got a cop car.
Yeah.
So easy to close in on him.
They said he was, I mean, I'm impressed with the Dhaka, with the Bangladesh police force for being able to find this guy hiding because it's mayhem in that country.
It's so populated.
It's so overpopulated. Yeah. But someone was, they must have had a reward or something, but they found him, brought him in. I identified him. He denied knowing me. Mm-hmm. But then after a couple of days of, I'm sure, horrible, horrible coercion, he admitted and pointed them out to the person who brought the drugs from, I think they said he was brought them in from Nigeria. So he had a third person that I had never laid eyes on that was coming to court every day with me for all the hearings. And it took some time. They told me to say I didn't know what it was, which I thought was ludicrous.
Who told you to say this?
My lawyer.
Okay. And was it a Bangladeshi lawyer?
It was a Bangladeshi lawyer. Okay.
And he was a good guy? Seemed to be on your side?
He tried to be. The embassy gave me a list, and it was, you know, alphabetical order. It was no particular order. They can't show any kind of preference to one or the other. And so I picked an Abdul something, and not the sharpest tool in the shed, I came to find out later. Yeah. I mean, I never needed a lawyer before. I mean, even with stuff with my dad, I was not involved with the legal aspects of it. So
I mean, who could navigate that? You know, let alone an 18-year-old who's never been outside of Texas.
Right, right. So I had a kind of a dope for a lawyer. He tried, and we got my sentence. It was not to be hanged, which they could have done. It was life, which in Bangladesh, the life sentence there is actually only 30 years.
That's
right. It's a signal of their life expectancy in that country. Is
wow.
Pretty short. So I was, I guess, 3.5 years into it when they, well, 3 years, I guess, when they finally sentenced me. And then we went to the high court, and the high court, I went and testified in front of the high court, and I was wearing shalwar kameez, the traditional outfit for the country, and I spoke in Bengali to the judges and told them, you know, I was very sorry, and I, you know,
Can you remember how to say what it is that you said in Bangladeshi?
It's been so long. I can understand.
Is that the right word, Bangladeshi?
It's Bengali.
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 I'm sorry.
That's Bangladeshi also works. Bengali. I haven't spoken it very much since I got back, but when I hear it, like the shop owners in New York are predominantly
that
from.
That must blow their mind.
And I hear it, I'm like, you're from Bangladesh. And they're like, yeah. It's like I can tell them, you know, shout a child, but shout Bangladesh and Madhya Basha Kursi. And that means I lived in Bangladesh for 4.5 years. And they're like, oh, where? Kotai. And I say, I said, I'm like, you won't believe me. And which is, I'm like a Bishesh Korbenna. You won't believe me. And I said, Bishesh Korbenna kano. Why wouldn't I believe you? And I said, I was in the Kendriyo Karagar, which is the central prison. And they all just look at me, no. So I testified and said, and they asked me, which was really sweet. The judges were kind of cute, these three white-haired men. And they were just like, so you're 18 now? And, of course, by then I was 22. And I said,
And so it's taken 3.5 years for your case to even be heard.
And that, well,
3.5 years for you waiting to find out if you get life.
Well, yeah, at 3.5 years, they sentenced me to life. I was going to hearings for about a year.
I see.
And it was a big to-do when I went to court. And I had braces, and I went to the medical college to get my braces tightened, and that was a big to-do. I mean, it was, I guess I shouldn't skim over this because it's surreal. There were people lining up the sidewalk entering into the prison or entering into the courthouse, and they were men with bouquets of roses because they'd seen my picture in the newspaper, and I have Indian features, and people often mistake me for being from the Southeast Asian continent. And so, and I was young and cute, and so they were proposing to me and were petitioning with my lawyer to be able to marry me and save me, and then we would, you know, hoping I would take them back to America once I was free, kind of a thing. So I had going to court as a you know, to be convicted of heroin smuggling, and I've got literally throngs of young men and mothers of young men waving and calling out to me, cheering on me like I was a movie star on the red carpet. It was bananas.
Bizarre.
Bananas.
Throngs of people who still want to use you, but in a less creepy way than you've been used.
Right.
My whole life,
yeah. The American, they want to use the American card.
You know, that's the beauty of life, is you never cease to encounter a new way that somebody wants to use or manipulate you.
There's always some new twist to it. Yeah. So, but I went to court, you know, several times, and the men, well, typically in that culture, if there's a man and a woman accused together in a case, it's, you know, they were intimately involved and committed this crime together. And, you know, and so that was assumed and encouraged by the jerk that was accused with me, the Tony. And so I would go to court and they would be like, you know, do you two want some time alone? Do you want to be in a cell by charge?
I'm like, they had to turn your stomach.
I was like, oh my God, do you know this man ruined my life? I'd never laid eyes on him until a day I was arrested, you know. Really, and people ask me now, like, have you heard where Tony is? But I was like, I don't give a rat's ass where that guy is. I hope he's rotting in prison still, you know? Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I understand there's a curiosity because he's part of the story when I tell it on National Geographic. And so, I mean, I guess technically I could care, but I really, really don't care.
Right.
And I've never asked or looked for it. But so went to high court and they asked me to lie about my age in order to be able to help me. Like, because if you're only 18 now, then you were underage when you were arrested and we would be forced to let you go. I was like, no, I'm 22. I said, my ID will show that. The American government can confirm that. Like, oh, paperwork can be forged. We wouldn't be able to rely on paperwork alone if you told us that you're on. I was like, really? And I said, I really am flattered, but I was not going to let... I wasn't going
to
go.
Do you feel like they were trying to lure you into a trap? Because then if they could show that you were lying, that would make it worse?
No, I think they were really... There was a lot of sympathy for me in the media.
Yeah.
And I think they really were looking for a way to let me get out of jail.
I see. Because the I would have thought that public opinion would have been hanger.
There was an element of that.
Yeah.
But it was not... From what I gathered, which, you know, my perspective, I'm sure, was skewed, but it was a lot of popularity. There were a lot of people who thought, you know, the American girl, she's so young and she's so innocent and let's, you know. And unless you had family who was serving time for similar crimes, you were very sympathetic.
Describe what you were feeling and thinking when you were thinking, I'm going to be in here the rest of my life. What is that like?
Well, when I was arrested and I first heard from the embassy that they weren't going to be able to get me extradited, I said, well, look, you have to get me out of here. I'm going to kill myself. I am not going to stay in this jail. It was horrible. I didn't speak the language at that time. It smelled awful. You know, these people were just
And you
weird.
Were in the good part of the
And
of
I was
the
in
prison.
My own cell. But yeah. I when I went in, the head woman in the jail, you know, spent a lot of time examining my chest. Like I might have been hiding something in my boobs. So I was like, really? She spent a lot of time. And I was like,
oh, really?
Awkward.
She was just kind of getting off.
A little friendly, yeah. And so I was like, I was creeped out. I wanted to leave. Yeah. And then when they sentenced me to 30 years, I actually knew that was going to happen a few days beforehand because they interrupted another drug case in the middle of its trial, mid-witness, and issued a sentence of 30 years because the embassy said you have to have a precedent of sentencing a woman from your country for a similar case before you can sentence an American to whatever.
I see.
So they stopped this woman's hearing and charged her, sentenced her to life. She got off on a technicality, but
It set
the precedent. So I knew she came back and she said, I have good news and I have bad news. And I was like, what? She goes, well, bad news is you're going to get life. The good news is I'm going home on a technicality because I just set the precedent for you, and it was in the middle of my hearings.
She really said that to you?
Uh-huh.
Did you kick her in the face?
No. No. She was kind of a tough
person. Did you strangle her with her sarong?
No. She came in putting her... She was grinning as she's folding her... They have an...
Is sarong even the right term?
Sorry.
Sorry.
Yeah, her sorry. She had the convict sorry on, and she's pleading it and just grinning from ear to ear. She goes, I'll be out of here in a month at the most.
What a bitch.
Yeah.
How do you... Oh my God!
It wasn't anything. It wasn't our fault, you know. I mean, I'm pretty good at not blaming the messenger.
Yeah, and you know, let's not forget too your complicity in this. You know, the fact that you were somebody who had experienced a tough childhood and had, you know, certainly been taught a lot of fucked up lessons. But you still chose to do this stuff.
Absolutely.
And you know, I don't want to gloss over that and make it sound like you're the victim in all this. And I don't get the sense that you feel that way
no,
either.
No, no. Yeah. I mean, I was surrounded by women who were in fact victims and had been framed and had been. I mean, there was the occasional actual murderer who would have described killing the 4-year-old son of her senior wife. But there were a lot of people who were there for. You know, had not done, since 80-year-old woman could barely lift her arm above her head accused of killing a man who was 30 years old. She couldn't have done it.
What did that feel like being around all of that, all those sad stories?
It was very humbling. And I wrote a poem about one woman because her kids were taken away from her and she couldn't take care of them and they took her land away. And it was very, humbling, and it gave me a perspective on, you know, my life had a lot of crap in it, but it was not that kind of crap, like not losing my family crap or not having no food on the table and, you know, wrongly imprisoned and taken away from infants and having the women could only keep their kids to a certain age, even in the jail. Then they went taken to an orphanage and the bureaucracy was impossible to get your kids out of that after that. So even if they got out of jail, the chances of reuniting with their children was very remote.
And does Bangladesh have the caste system like India does?
Yes.
So, yeah. So if you're from the lower caste, you're less than a citizen, if even that.
Right. Yeah. So it was, I got a sense of perspective and I learned that there's more than one. I had always had an issue with hell growing up with the religion of my dad, you know, like if you're not a Christian, you know, way, the truth, the light, there's no one gets to the gate by to heavens through me. But I thought, you know, there's a lot of people who aren't Christian. And I've known some pretty crappy Christians looking at my dad. And I just didn't think that God was populating the planet with people to fill hell. I didn't think hell needed fuel. I feel like that was just not something that God would do. So when I went over there and I met all the people who were not Christian, there was maybe two Christian women in the whole time I was there. There were several Hindus, but even that was a very small minority. And I thought, you know, these women are suffering and they're praying and they're, you know,
living with dignity.
Living with dignity.
And compassion for each other.
Exactly. And so I... And it was funny. They said they would do their prayers, and I would ask what they were doing. They were fasting 1 year, and I was like, why aren't you eating? There's no food coming. What's going on with that? Like, mine's the only food coming. And they said, oh, no, this is our sacred fast. And I was like, what do you mean a sacred fast? And they said, well, you Americans don't have this. You don't have the discipline. Yeah. I'm a Texas teenager who's just left home and flown across the world to come here, and you've just thrown down the gauntlet. I was like, all right, what do you have to do? Bring it.
Really?
I learned the prayers in Arabic. I learned how to read the Arabic alphabet for the Quran with the little vowel sounds above and below it. And I did prayer 5 times a day. I fasted from dawn till dusk. And I went through the whole, you know, singing into certain nights that you're supposed to be up all night singing. And I was like, okay, I've done it. And they said, so now you're truly Muslim. And I said, no, you know, I appreciate the value of focusing on you know, the supreme being that you know, on Allah. I think that's valuable. I said, but I think Christianity has a direct line that doesn't require all the ritual. I don't think I was
it kind of a welcome distraction that gave you something to focus your mind on other
something
than going, I'm fucked?
Yes, something to do with my time. Maybe.
I'm fucked? Oh, great, rice again. How many times did you think that? Rice, really?
I didn't used to like rice as a kid, and now I love it. Like, I have an awesome...
Does it remind you of that prison?
No, I love it. I love rice. I love Indian food. Like, if I go...
Indian food's the best.
If I eat an Indian meal, I'm full for the day. Like, it makes me happy. The flavors make me happy. I have nothing really hurtful or upset about actual what happened when I was there. Like, I recognized that I deserved to be there. I walked into that. And there were people that wanted to help, and I could, like, this missionary I'd never laid eyes on was coming to see me once a month. I went through all kinds of trouble to be able to come and see me and help me out for no reason. Bill Richardson was the congressman of New Mexico at the time. He heard my story when he came to DACA for some other purpose.
Bill Richardson.
Yeah. And the embassy people had, you know, we're all familiar with my story. They were all sending me little goodies. I got these big gift boxes of goodies once a month from books and shower gel and stuff.
So it sounds like there wasn't ever really a point where you felt forgotten in there, because so often that's that when somebody gets locked up abroad, oftentimes there's not connection with the embassy and they feel like I'm just withering away and nobody knows that.
Yeah,
that was
no,
not
that,
your, you never had that feeling.
No, not at all.
Okay.
I was very, very fortunate in that regard. And I was the first American ever arrested in Bangladesh, ever. Mm. And so it was a novelty. And I had a couple of Foreign Service agencies. It was their first assignment. And they got sent there because it was kind of a good training ground before you go to the other countries. And so having a prisoner there was a whole new thing, but it was part of the consular's jobs. And so they came to see me. And they were really sweet. I mean, they were green. They were wet behind the ears, too, so they weren't really sure what they were supposed to do. And I like to think I was charming.
Yeah.
So they would bring me all kinds of goodies. It was like Christmas every month.
Right.
So, I forget where I was.
Yeah, I'm sorry I interrupted
that's
you
okay.
because I thought that was so important to interrupt you.
No, that's
I
okay.
Do that. I do that a lot.
That's okay. No, but I've had people say, you know, that They've had other...
Oh, Bill Richardson. You're talking about Bill Richardson.
So Bill Richardson heard about me from the embassy folks, and they said, you know, we want to do something for her, but we can't because America has the war on drugs and we can't do anything on her behalf. But as a member of the American government, you could ask their government for a pardon. And so he did. He says, yeah, let's do it. What do we have to do? Let's get this girl home. And again, my congressmen and senators were getting letters from my parents and were non-responsive. So I have huge appreciation for Bill Richardson. Mm-hmm. And he sent me this postcard, you know, I've heard your story and we're going to get you home soon. And I like put that, I was like, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. I had zero. I mean, I just didn't think, how could you? Why would you? July 4th, they gave they read their statement. They said, you know, while we feel for this young woman, the law is not meant to be sympathetic. And according to the laws of this country, she has, in fact, broken them and is appropriately sentenced to life for her crimes. But we would ask the government to take a look at this. And we would encourage her lawyer to pursue, you know, some sort of clemency from the prime minister or the president, because that is what they are there for.
I see.
And so, and that was actually much better, because I think having a pardon is better than having a shortened conviction. Like, I would have gotten out maybe a little bit sooner.
Right.
But I actually ended up with no record. I didn't know how long it would take for the pardon. I thought it would take a lot longer. But Bill Richardson came back again. They advertised that he was coming again in another week. And I was like, something in my head said, oh my God, he's coming to take me home. Mm-hmm. I suddenly knew. There's this caucus, whatever he says he's coming for. He's coming to take me home. I just knew it. And this embassy guys came and said, you know, if you were to get your pardon and if you were to go home, then this would be your schedule. And they had this minute by moment schedule. And I was like, yeah, if, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, I'm so out of here. You know, I was... Mm-hmm. I had a couple of days of just being ecstatically knowing. They took my picture for my passport because my passport had gotten stolen. Shocker.
So then you get released. You come back home to America. You start living your life. Am I skipping over anything that you feel is...
The flight home was kind of crazy.
Yeah?
Because I was panicked. I was like, I have been in prison for 4.5 years, and I'm going home. And it was... Like, my youngest brother, when I left in 92, was 12. And I was coming home to a 16, 17-year-old boy, like, man, almost.
Yeah.
And they had sent me some pictures, and I didn't recognize my own siblings. Like, they'd all grown up. And I didn't have any skills. I hadn't worked. I mean, I just couldn't imagine what I was going to do. Like, I was very scared. And I was missing my friends I'd made in jail. Every day I would wake up, and there was a couple of older women who would come and look at me, and they would be praying and looking at me through my little window in my cell. And I asked her, I said, why? What are you doing? And she goes, you're just so beautiful. You're like this light in this jail, and I just like to look at you when you're sleeping.
You're so beautiful?
Yes. And I was thinking, I'm not going to have that when I go home. You know, it was so many things I just was missing, and they would come. I had people.
How did that make you feel when she said that?
It was surreal. I don't know what it would have been like, I guess, not to hear it, because I heard it so many times. Like, they said I looked like one of their Hindu goddesses. And I had letters, the few letters that came through from local men, just going on and on about how beautiful I was and I should be in movies. And I thought, you know, I, in the middle of just being really down on myself for being so stupid, and I mean, to be there in the first place and losing all of this time and not seeing my brothers and sisters, and I was worried more for them missing me and knowing that was hurting them than I was about myself. I mean, I was where I was supposed to be. I screwed up. This is what I get. But I also knew that I was the big sister and that they looked to me. And I got letters from my little brother and my little sister, and I could tell they were hurting. And that was harder on me than what I was actually going through. Going through there was hearing how gorgeous I was and how smart I was and learning a new language. And I did. I learned the language pretty quickly, and I felt proud of myself. I got the sense of, I had a really strong sense of me as an individual person, an entity separate from my family, an entity separate from the people around me, because I wasn't one of them. Mm-hmm. But I certainly felt a connection with them, and I just became aware, really self-aware. You know, this is who I am. I was reading some things, and for the first time in my life, I felt like I had permission to disagree with something I read. Because I always was... in school, you're supposed to, this is what you learn. Yeah. This is what you just agree with it. You agree. And then I was reading, like, you know, I disagree with that. You know, I'd always had issues with hell in the Bible. That was my only one thing that I knew I disagreed with. But I got to a point where I read so many things and I had formed some opinions.
Well, like, what things were you reading that you were disagreeing with?
There was some philosophy books I got.
So you were just devouring books while you were...
Oh, yes. Then, yeah. Anything the embassy people read and they got, they handed it back to me, you know, and fiction. Like, I got a book that I didn't like it. I was like, and I don't have to finish it.
Yeah.
Like, I am not enjoying Clive Barker. I'm disgusted. I'm going to stop.
I think that you should start... You should have other girls go through this, and it would be like your Bradford Business School, and you show them walking out of the Bangladesh prison and saying...
She's a Yale grad!
Yes, I learned how to question during my commuted life sentence on smuggling drugs.
When I came back, my dad said, you know what, Jill was good for you. He goes, listen to you arguing and standing up for yourself. He goes, it really did you some good. And I just thought, you know, and who beat me down? You jerk.
Did you believe him? Or were you able to see that when he said that? That jail had done you some good?
My immediate response, I remember feeling very good. Like, oh, thanks.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't condemn him for being the person who beat me down at the time. But I thought back about it, like, you know. Yeah.
You know, that to me is one of the things in life that is so... it's so easy to overlook is the fact that really, really tough stuff can be the best thing that ever happens to us sometimes. But when we're going through it, it's so miserable and it's so hard. And I'm struck by hearing your story. The two things that kind of stick out to me both involve patience. You know, the mistake that you made of smuggling the drugs. To me, it's not that you were a bad person or that you were a not smart person. It was that you lacked the patience to believe that some good stuff in life was going to come your way, that you were going to be able to fulfill some type of dream or educate yourself or anything like that. And you thought, I've got to force it. I've got to break my moral code to make this happen because it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And then the patience of you being in this prison and using it to kind of expand your mind. I suppose it was easier in that your prison was not as hellish as it could have been, and you had these people that were caring for you. But I don't know, that just kind of the word patience just kind of jumps out at me.
I consider myself an incredibly impatient person.
Yeah.
I have my poor mother, when I was in dance practice after school, if she was late picking me up, there was hell to pay. It just made me so angry. I hate waiting, and I hate making people wait because I know how much I hate waiting. So patience has never been a good. And then I have friends that say, you know, Leah, you put up with things for so long. I can't believe you don't think you're patient. And so I guess it depends on what form the waiting is taking. Like, if I'm consciously aware that I'm actually waiting for something, and I can't take it. But if I'm trudging through something that's maybe not necessarily a nice situation, but just going through something, I have a lot more patience.
So when you go through something today, do you ever look back on your time in that prison and draw on any of that for strength? Or is it something you just kind of put behind you and don't really think about?
When I'm going through, I tend to have a really high positive attitude, and people are like, you know, God, you're so upbeat. And I know that I'm looking back, and it could be worse. I mean, I count the years. I would technically still be, I just be getting out maybe of prison. So everything's better than being behind bars in a third world country away from my family. So when I'm going through something hard, that does come up. I do think about that. It's still very immediate appreciation for what I have and where I'm at.
To me, one of the benefits of having gone through stuff that's painful is I know that there's always something beautiful or good, even in the worst circumstances. If I can really try to find the good or the positive, there's always something in it. And do you feel like that is something that you're more attuned to now, that you're able to...
I am more attuned to that there's something good about it, or that there's a reason it's happening. Mm-hmm. You know, this doesn't have to necessarily be good, but it will be good for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that has helped me because I use the metaphor of a diamond. I like that. It's a black piece of coal, and it's not attractive. And it goes through incredible, incredible pressure, squeeze to become this gorgeous diamond. Mm-hmm. And I think that we humans in our development, we have to go. I mean, no, you don't have to. I find that when we go through the storm, when we weather storm after storm after storm and just keep coming through it, I think it just hones and brightens and adds to the sparkle of who we can be if we choose to use it as a growth and not as a knocking you down. I mean, you hit a wall and you can choose that that's helping you to get over the wall, or you can say you're going to lay there or mm-hmm. dig under the wall and just get lower and lower. And I find that because of what happened and getting out of jail was so miraculous, and I came out with a pardon, and I've had some pretty wonderful things happen in my life, that I choose to see obstacles. They suck. They're never fun. But if I recognize it, it's going to be good for me to have gone through this. Like, there's got to be a reason I have to go through this. I'm just going to get through this and get to the next thing.
Yeah.
And that's been...
Well, I want to thank you for being my guest. And
my pleasure.
Opening up and talking about some stuff that I know couldn't have been easy. But I appreciate it. And it would probably be inappropriate to ask if you wanted to go get high.
That would be
I don't do it anymore. But how ironic would that be if we then went... We went and... Oh, boy, that was stressful. Let's go get loaded. Then we got busted. But thank you. Is there any thing that you'd like to plug? A website or a Facebook thing?
I have a fan page on Facebook. I just topped 900 fans on my Facebook fan
awesome.
Page, which is really exciting. So if you go to Leah McCord, there's my personal profile, and then there's the public... First profile, it's a fan page.
Okay.
It's a picture of me and the girl who played me in the reenactments on Locked Up Abroad. So,
Okay. Yeah.
So I fan me, send me questions. I'm working on writing my book. So if you have things you'd like to hear more about, that's feeding my content of my book. So I love questions. I love knowing what else people want to know.
Well, I'm touched by the amount of forgiveness that you've had for, you know, not only the people that hurt you in your childhood, but for yourself. That's a really, really beautiful quality for a human being to have, and really important. I think one of the best tools to go through life with is being able to forgive yourself and other people. So
it's important. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks,
Leah.
Thank you. My pleasure.
As I said before, this is where I thought the interview had ended, and then we had a conversation out in the hallway. There was something that she felt like she still wanted to say, but wasn't sure if it was appropriate for the show. And I said, no, I think it's totally appropriate for the show. So we came back in, and here's where we picked that up. So the age at which your father began molesting you was what?
I think I was eight, seven and a half or eight.
Uh-huh.
And it went on for a little over 4 years.
Uh-huh.
So... at first, it didn't feel like anything, right? I mean, at eight years old, you don't have those responses. Your body's just doesn't have the sexual reactions. But at one point, I remember it actually felt good. And I actually had, you know, a release, you mm-hmm. know, a climax. My first climax was like 11 or 12 years old with my father.
It had to have been very confusing.
It was really odd. And I just thought, whoa, that felt good. And
but what was your emotion? I mean, was it all positive, or was it a conflict?
I felt really confused. Like, I know that that's what he had wanted, and his response, because he could tell, was very excited. He was very proud of himself. He was very excited that it you know, that's what's supposed to happen. That's normal, baby. And then I had known, because we had turned him in a couple of times before that. My older brother was the one that was like, he's not supposed to be touching you. He's not supposed to be doing that. We're taking him to the police. We're getting out of here. My brother was always, we were running away in the middle of the night, and my mom would come and find us. And so I knew that I was not supposed to be enjoying it. It was wrong, and it was bad. And I felt really conflicted at enjoying it. And so I never actually went after it at first. And then there was one instance where I, you know, I couldn't sleep, and we were at my grandparents' house, and we were on a fold-out sofa, and he placed himself next to me, laying on the bed next to me, and I instigated it. I couldn't stop thinking about, you know, how good it felt, and I wanted to feel that. And so I, you know, feigned sleep, rolled over, put myself in a position that I knew he would start doing what he likes to do. And he did, and then I went to sleep. And then later on, several months later, when we turned him in for the final time, and we had to say something was in Dallas that we chose to turn him in, and I was supposed to say what happened in Dallas, what did he do to you? And I retold that story, but without the fact that I had started it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I went to therapy, and they said, you know, it's not your fault. He's the bad one. He should know better. He shouldn't do that to you. You can't blame yourself. I nodded my head and, oh yeah, sure, right. And in the back of my mind, I was convicting myself because no, I actually did start that. You know, I wanted that and I enjoyed that, and I am bad because I did start that. And years and years and years, I mean, it was just a couple of years ago that I actually saw something that hit home, and then I want people who have been through that, like, you started out getting abused before you knew what it was, before you had any reaction, and you're programmed to accept that, and then it starts to feel good. It's not your fault for enjoying what naturally feels good. That's biology. But
your body doesn't have a sense of morality.
Right. So, but we still feel this guilt. We carry this guilt for any of you out there who have ever purposely kind of placed yourself or instigated an incident with your abuser. And I saw the movie Towelhead with Toni Collette and I think it was Thomas Jane. I can't think of his name. But the young girl seduces her neighbor. She can tell he kind of likes her, and she goes over and she seduces him. And Toni Collette picks up that there's something inappropriate happening. Her character does. And she brings her over to the house, and she's telling her, you know, it's not your fault. You know, he is wrong. What he did is wrong. And she's like, no, but I wanted it. Which was very brave for her to say, because I know I would never have said that to someone when I was at that age and it had happened.
But you didn't start out wanting it.
Well, no, I didn't start out wanting it. But the thing that Toni Collette said to her afterwards, it registered with me as an adult hearing it and thinking back. She says, no, honey, he is an adult and you are a child. And no matter what you did or said, he should have known better. It is his place to protect you and not behave inappropriately with you. He should not have done that.
Right.
And so I thought, yeah, if my 10 or 11-year-old nephews, because I've got a few, were to, you know, come into their puberty and were to, you know, watch me or try and start something with me, never in a million years.
Right.
Absolutely. I mean, just ludicrous, the concept, the thought of it. And so I got this sense of, oh,
why can't I feel that way towards myself?
Like, why did that never register with me? Like, people kept saying it's not your fault, but they weren't realizing that I was blaming myself because I had actually kind of wanted it, I finally started enjoying it.
Right.
And so I think a lot, I don't know how many others are out there, but that is the thing you need to remind yourself. As an adult person looking back, look at the youngsters at the age you were when you were abused and when you started liking it even. Mm-hmm. If someone of that age came to you, would you ever? And how wrong is that?
Right.
And recognize that that is what your abuser did wrong, is that they went ahead when they absolutely had no place.
Right. Because the adult knows that there are ramifications to it, that it's a lot of different stuff is mixed up in there, that child is probably wanting for attention and a lot of things in other ways. And the adult knows that all of that stuff, but the child doesn't know that.
No.
The child just knows somebody's paying attention to me or something feels good physically, but they don't know the full package that it's coming in. And you can't, you can't judge.
Right.
That's a really profound and brave thing for you to say. And I really, really appreciate that you said that, because I imagine there's a lot of people out there that are still blaming themselves for something, and that forgiving yourself is so, so important if you're ever going to feel better about yourself.
Right.
Or how you feel about other people.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I've learned that the other thing about the abuse from my dad, and knowing that my dad loves me, and he did this horrible thing to me. And it has led to me in relationships, people who are treating me less than the way they should be, I keep giving them the benefit of the doubt that they really do love me more than they really do. Mm-hmm. And not letting their actions tell me how they feel about me. So that's been something I'm having to teach myself over and over again.
How do you set boundaries, though, when it hurts you the way those people treat you? Or I should say, are you able to set boundaries when... Because I think there's a certain point at which it's okay to, you know, have empathy for towards them and take their actions with a grain of salt. But at a certain point, we have to draw a line and say, okay, this is
the end.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm constantly reminding myself to set that boundary. Mm-hmm. And I almost got married to someone who was basically a project. You know, I was trying to prove to myself that I just said no. And I had my sister-in-law and my brother, we all talked, and they said, Leah, really, why are you considering marrying this person? Considering how they treat you and the things they say to you. I was like, yeah.
Did you think you wanted to change that person? Or something about the way they treated you felt familiar and comfy?
Felt familiar was kind of the bad things, the things I thought were wrong with myself, they thought was wrong with me. And kind of went on and on about it.
She thought, oh, this person's...
They know me so well. They get me.
They get me. They know I'm a piece of shit.
And rather than lifting me up and recognizing some of the great things that I've had people, you know, comment on about me, I was like, you know, I really need to find the person that's more about what's great about me and not about what's hung up on me.
God, thank God you did. And you held off on having kids and not bringing kids in to do a dysfunctional marriage.
Yeah, no. I'm still alone, but I feel confident that I'm better alone than I would have been with either of the two folks I'd considered marrying when I was much younger.
Yeah, so many people get into horrible relationships because they're terrified of being alone. They think it's a comment on who they are as a person.
Yeah.
And it can be such a mistake.
True that.
Great. Many thanks to Leah McCord for that great and brave interview. Thank you guys for listening. If you feel so disposed, go to iTunes, give us a good rating, write something nice, and that boosts our ranking, brings more people to the show. Remember, this is a tough time of year. I have personally cried about 8 buckets of tears in the last 3 weeks, but I know it's not reality. It's just my brain. So if you're out there and you feel stuck, you ain't alone. Thanks for listening.